RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Paul Marrick is an American physician and former professor of medicine who, until his resignation in January 2022, served as chair of the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, Virginia. He was also a critical care doctor at Sentara Norfolk General Hospital. His research interests include sepsis and tissue oxygenation. He works with the Frontline Critical Care Alliance, and he will be a guest speaker at the NZD SOS conference later this month. It's my pleasure to welcome Paul Marrick to our radio program. Dr. Marrick, thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. It's been a bit of a rough ride for you from about January 2022. Just curious.
Yeah, so, you know, COVID brought a lot of change and opened up, you know, the eyes of many people. For better or for worse, it changed my career because basically I was forced to resign and couldn't practice as a critical care doctor. But it did change my direction and what I do. I think COVID was a turning point.
Yeah, interesting you say that. We've talked to a lot of people about the consequences of that and the impact it had on their careers and personal lives. And, resetting for many hasn't been such a bad thing as it's turned out. Is there any bitterness there, though, that, you were forced to go in a different direction in the way it happened?
Well, yes and no. You know, obviously it's changed what I do. And maybe in my new role, I've been able to touch and, much more people. But it's different. You know, I was a bedside clinician. And so I really was prevented from practicing medicine, what I had trained for 30 years. So I do, I do miss the bedside medicine and the clinical medicine. But, it's a different role. One has to change and adapt to the changing circumstances. It's not something I would have predicted or something that I would particularly have wanted to happen, but it happened.
Yeah.
You have to go with the flow.
Indeed. The whole issue of repurposed drugs is interesting. You tend to forget about what's already been invented and been around for a while. And I'm interested to hear what you have to say about vitamin C. And I'm looking at a piece that you wrote a while back, and that is in the Desert Review, Marrick's Miracle, How the Loss of One Career Fueled the Spectacular Rise of Another is the heading. But it says that you're a trailblazer in the use of repurposed drugs. So what is it that you have to say about vitamin C and sepsis? And just to mention, I've had a family member who had a very narrow escape with sepsis in the hospital for 9 days. It was pretty rough. So I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Yeah. So, the physiology is really fascinating. So it's more of a stress hormone than a vitamin. And so what's interesting is that all species on this planet, including plants, when they stress to make vitamin C, it's a really essential defense mechanism, except human beings and guinea pigs. So that humans are genetically mutants and they can't make vitamin C. And vitamin C is essential for the organism when it's stressed. So that what happens is when you're stressed and you can't make vitamin C, you become vitamin C depleted. Mm. And so it's not a stretch of the imagination to postulate that giving sick people, and really doesn't matter what the illness is, vitamin C will help them because it is really a stress hormone. You know, together with cortisol and epinephrine and norepinephrine, the body normal, non-human mutants, dogs and cats and sheep, when they stress and get septic, make vitamin C. Humans can't make vitamin C. They need to take it orally or intravenously.
Hmm. It's interesting that guinea pigs are in the same camp as us. I wonder how that happened.
Yeah, you know, evolution's a strange thing. I don't know why guinea pigs are our partners in this crime.
It turns out that we descended from guinea pigs, maybe. I don't know. Okay, so one thing that, again, it's anecdotal, and you sure have a better view on it than us probably, is sepsis on the rise. I've heard, you know, more cases, and I mentioned the one that I'm familiar with. Has it been an issue more recently, let's say?
So, you know, I think with, you know, firstly, COVID had a really profound effect on the immune system. And so both COVID and particularly the vaccines cause immune impairment. And if it impairs your immune system, you're much more likely to get an overwhelming infection. So I think particularly post, you know, the COVID jabs, the incidence has gone up. And then we have an aging population with many comorbidities, which increase the risk of sepsis. So sepsis is a really important problem that most people really aren't familiar with unless someone in the family has had sepsis, much like yourself.
Yeah, and that was a younger person in their early 30s. Is that normal?
You know, it's not. Yeah, it happens. I mean, sepsis doesn't discriminate. It affects younger people as well as older people. It's more common in older people, but certainly, you know, being young and healthy is no protection that you won't become septic, particularly, you know, if you've been vaccinated.
Yeah. How does it attack the body? Can you tell us?
So basically what sepsis is the body's response to overwhelming infection. The best way to describe it is if you have a local infection, that's called an infection. When it spreads beyond the local site of the infection, it's called sepsis. So it's the body's response to an infection. So for example, if you have an infection in the knee that's localized to the knee, that's arthritis. But once it spreads beyond the knee, the patient can become septic. So it's the whole body response to an infection.
And how bad can it be? It can kill, right?
Without question of doubt, something like in the US, 300,000 people die of sepsis every year. So it's a serious disease. You should never underestimate the power and the pathophysiology of sepsis.
I know in the case I mentioned, it also involved seizures. That's part of it, obviously.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a multi-system disease, so it can affect, you know, numerous different organ systems. And, you know, it terminates in a condition called septic shock. So it progresses from sepsis to severe sepsis to septic shock, where the body goes into shock with very low blood pressure.
Is that what I'm just remembering back? Was it the 70s toxic shock that was suffered by women? Was that sepsis?
So, you know, they're all varieties of the same concept. So the toxic shock syndrome was due to a bacterial toxin produced by a particular bacteria, which, you know, in that instance was associated with tampons, but it does cause a systemic inflammatory response. So in a way, they're cousins.
Okay. And the normal treatment is what, in the case that, again, I'm thinking of, that I know
yes.
about,
yes.
is just huge waves of antibiotics. I think it was 6-hour infusions over 9 days, which seems like a throwing everything at the thing.
So it's a very time-sensitive disease. So, you know, if you're septic, you don't want to wait at home. So the most important intervention is antibiotics, is first-line therapy, then fluids, and then I would say vitamin C. Now, people would argue with me, but the importance of vitamin C is it has to be given early. And so there have been a few trials, including a trial in Australia, where they gave it ridiculously late. So, you know, we know that every hour delay in giving antibiotics makes a big difference. So in this study, they gave antibiotics when the patients first presented, but they gave vitamin C, we think, at least 24 hours after they presented. It was a ridiculously designed study. So, you know, I believe vitamin C works. It's very safe. It makes a lot of sense, but it needs to be given early.
Vitamin C has also been cited for cancer as well. I mean, I don't want to veer too much off sepsis, but is there anything in that?
Yes. So there is high-dose intravenous. So it's a different dosing strategy, and it works differently. But high-dose intravenous vitamin C, it has been used as an adjunct to chemotherapy and radiotherapy in patients with cancer. And it increases the cell killing or cytotoxicity of chemotherapeutic drugs.
And is it usual to, antibiotics for sepsis if you arrive at the emergency room, is vitamin C used in the normal course of that treatment normally?
So, unfortunately, it's not commonly used. I think, one has very little to lose. It's exceedingly safe. And we think it has a positive impact on the disease. But because of some of the negative studies and because it's cheap, it's not widely used.
Cheap meaning that there's no money to be made from it.
Absolutely. There's no profit margin. So it seems like hospitals and big pharma and the industrial complex don't have much of an interest in vitamin C.
But it makes sense, doesn't it, if it's safe, to throw everything you can think at the problem.
Exactly. What do you have to lose? We know it's very safe. And the data shows that it has some benefit, not just in terms of reducing the risk of death, but in improving organ function, getting off patients off ventilators sooner. So it has a whole host of beneficial effects.
And everyday supplementation then is beneficial in that way in a more general sense, is it?
So, yeah, but I think mostly when you stress. So, when people are stressed either physically, mentally, psychologically, I think that, vitamin C is a good thing to supplement. If you have a good diet that has adequate vegetables and fruits, I think you get enough in the diet. But certainly when the body is stressed, either mentally or physically, it's probably a good idea to supplement with additional vitamin C.
Yeah, people know when they're feeling stressed, especially mentally, don't they? I guess when you're feeling that way, just pop a vitamin C.
it's exceedingly cheap. You can buy a bottle at the pharmacy or drugstore, wherever you get it, for a few dollars. So it's very safe. So you've got nothing to lose.
I want to ask you about the broader picture on repurposed drugs, because obviously it comes to mind through COVID, and it seems to have been borne out now that ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and I guess some other drugs as well seem to be able to play a part in treating people with COVID. And now I'm hearing reports that that ivermectin anyway may have some benefit for cancer, and I've had cancer before, so I know what that's like. Here in New Zealand, probably similar to where you are in other places, ivermectin was demonized as horse paste, as I'm sure you know, but also it was withdrawn. You couldn't get hold of it, even though it has this, like vitamin C, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, this quite incredible safety record over decades, I think 6 decades or 4 decades, maybe, for ivermectin. This kind of rejection of repurposing drugs, what's that all about, Paul?
Yeah, so it's a big issue. So basically, just so that people understand what a repurposed drug is. So this is a drug which, in the US anyway, is FDA approved. So this is a drug which is approved by the regulatory bodies. What you're doing is you're using it for an off-label or an indication, or an indication for which the drug wasn't registered. So, for example, amoxicillin, which is penicillin, is used to treat otitis media, which is an ear infection. When you use it to treat an ear infection, it's being used off-label. That's the drug wasn't registered to use it for otitis media. So many, many drugs, at least in the US anyway, 30 to 40% of drugs are used off-label. The fact that it's off-label means that often it's generic and that it's an inexpensive drug. And so we come again to the money. There's no money to be made in repurposed drugs. So the pharmaceutical industry, you know, it's the bane of their existence because they, you know, it challenges everything they have. And so there is a war on repurposed drugs. As you say, I mean, it's astonishing that ivermectin was banned in countries like New Zealand. It's one of the safest medications on the planet. You know, it wasn't just, you know, people think that this is horse medicine. Millions of patients in Africa and in South America received ivermectin for the treatment of parasitic diseases. And it was, after penicillin, it was a revolutionary drug. It's the only antibiotic or antiviral drug to get the Nobel Prize. You know, so it's very safe. Billions of doses have been dispensed. It's very effective against COVID in many aspects. It acts via multiple pathways to inactivate the SARS-2 virus. It interferes with the pathophysiology. It's a very effective drug, but it obviously went against the narrative. And so that's why, particularly with COVID, it was so demonized. And part of the problem was, is in order to get an EUA, which is an emergency use authorization for the vaccines and experimental drugs, in order to get an EUA, there has to be, according to the rules, no effective alternative drug. No effective alternative drug. And so therefore, ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine posed a severe threat to the vaccines, because if you could prove that ivermectin was effective, then they would not have been able to get the temporary authorization to use the vaccines. And so I think that's the crux of what happened. It's an outrage, because it's a very effective, and it's exceedingly cheap. And you know, it's on the WHO's list of essential medicine. It cost the WHO 2 cents for a 6-milligram tablet.
It's incredible that that would happen. I understand the economics of it, but I knew a few people who had COVID and were in quite a bad way and were even having breathing difficulties and were told by the health line to stay at home until you're blue in the face and then call the ambulance. And knowing that there were drugs around, like we're describing now, that could have prevented that is, well, it's kind of immoral, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. That's how, you know, the FLCCC started and we got into this, is that the NIH, the WHO, and all these regulatory bodies were saying, you know, there's no treatment. Stay at home. Stay at home till you get blue, then go to the hospital, which is absurd, because there's no disease that doctors aren't going to try and treat. I mean, it's an absurdity. If patients are sick, you're going to try something. And so that's how we started the FLCCC, because we knew ivermectin was effective and we developed protocols for the early treatment. And there's no question of doubt, if patients were treated early with ivermectin, much like they were done in many places in the world, you know, in Uttar Pradesh in India, they had a protocol where it was distributed widely and they almost wiped out COVID. So if we had, you know, if there wasn't all this profiteering and these hidden agendas, and ivermectin was allowed to be used, you know, appropriately, I'm sure it would have changed the face of COVID.
And of course, the media here reported it as horse paste and didn't do any reporting at all on the history of the medication, how it has been used over the time, as you've just explained. So I heard people, you know, repeating those words as if they, well, they believed it. So it's pretty tragic. Anyway.
The FDA went on this marketing and advertising strategy of, you know, it's, you're not a horse, you're not a cow, stop it. You know, it's horse medicine. And obviously they did that as part of their narrative. I'm not sure if you know this, but we actually, myself and two colleagues, sued the FDA over this issue. You know, we took them to court and actually we prevailed. The Fifth Circuit Court in the U.S. ruled that the FDA exceeded their jurisdiction. They weren't a body which can provide medical care, and that they were, you know, severely reprimanded for what they did. It's one of the few successful lawsuits.
Well done. Congratulations. Back to vitamin C. So maybe someone's listening at the moment and they don't know now, but they might have or get sepsis, go to the hospital. Should that person insist on vitamin C as part of the course of their treatment? Would you advocate that?
Yeah, you know, you asked such a difficult question. The answer is obviously yes. It's something that I would recommend. As I said, you have nothing to lose. It's very safe. It's very economical. But the problem is, you know, doctors don't, you know, they don't think independently. They're taught, you know, medicine has become protocolized and therapy has become dictated by governing bodies and hospitals and boards. So it's doctors may be scared and maybe intimidated to use vitamin C. And again, they may, much like the ivermectin, they may not understand the physiology and the clinical science. But, you know, my advice would be, yes, always, you know, at least ask for vitamin C.
Okay. And if you get pushback, maybe it's for everyone to decide their own circumstances, but maybe be empowered with a little more information than just, I want vitamin C. So you can kind of explain, if you telegraph that you have more knowledge, are you more likely to get a better response?
You know, I think what makes makes most sense is a educated discussion with a healthcare provider. You know, right. The days where healthcare providers dominate and are not responsive to feedback, I think, is gone. And so I think, you know, if you engage in an educated conversation with them, you're more likely to get somewhere. So I would engage them in a, you know, a cordial conversation.
Want to get to now the NZD SOS conference. There are two of them in Auckland, in our North Island, Christchurch in our South Island. And you will be beaming in to talk to the conference. What are you planning to say, Dr. Merrick?
So actually, I'm going to be there in person.
Are you physically there? I beg your pardon.
I'm going to be physically there. I'm getting on an aeroplane and I'm flying across to the bottom of the world.
Yeah, oh, you'll love that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, you know, the title is Empowering Change, Methods, Motivation, and Evidence.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to be talking about is the COVID tragedy. Basically, how we were lied to, you know, everything they told us was a lie. And then because of COVID, I think it's opened up a new door, and it's basically, it can empower patients and people to take their health into their own hands. You know, I think we know now from COVID, the healthcare system is completely broken. It's a disease system. It's based on treating symptoms and disease. It's not based on promoting health and well-being. So I think that, you know, part of the talk will be to empower people to take matters in their own hands, the things that they can do to improve their health. And I think that you have to be very suspicious of the healthcare system.
That's so sad, isn't it?
It's a tragedy. I mean, I've practiced medicine for 35 years, and it's really sad have to talk about the system in such a negative way. There's no question of doubt. It's a broken system. And people have to recognize that, and they need to empower themselves. Much like in COVID, they could empower themselves, you know, by many, many nutraceuticals and ivermectin that they could take to prevent them going to hospital. And so there are many things that people can do to prevent diseases such as cancer, metabolic syndrome, diabetes. You know, these are largely preventable diseases. So cancer is largely a preventable disease. And there are measures people can take to improve their health and lessen their chances of getting cancer.
Well, I'm hoping to be at the Christchurch event, so maybe I can shake your hand and meet you in person. That would be a great thing. Paul Marek, MD, thank you for coming on our radio show this morning and having this chat. It's very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Look forward to seeing you.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.